Well, good evening. Welcome to the Film Larkin event. And we've gone to extra special efforts this evening. We've had this bitter wind blown in from the steppes, just to sort of give you a good sense of Russia. More of a sense of Russia is going to come from our guests, which I'm delighted to meet for the first time myself and to sort of welcome here to Hull. Susan Richards, who, unknowing to her, she received many of my old editions of Granta many years ago when she started up this charity called Book Aid, sending books out to the sort of the newly opened Russia. I think more than 1 million books were sent off, and all through your living room. And Susan is immensely engaged in this sort of life of Russia, from her PhD in Solzhenitsyn to being the editor of Open Democracy Russia. And so she'll be sort of fielding questions afterwards, herself and David, about the writing process, about the nature of these two terrific books, but also about anything you might want to sort of ask about sort of Russia now. And so Susan won an award for her first book quite a way back now in 1990, and this is the fruit of the following 19 years of following that same track, of really engaging with people's lives in Russia. And so we'll be conjuring some of the magic of the book in conversation. And David sort of shook the world and won the Betty Trask Award for, it was for a romantic novel. Was it particularly romantic? I think the trustees. It's a romantic novel on hallucinogens, I think. London and the South East. And then the second book was quite a departure. It was a book called The Innocent, which takes place in, it's narrated from 1972, still within the communist era, looking back to incidents that were happening in the 1940s. So I was particularly intrigued to gather these two writers today to see how Russia is explored, sort of both by somebody sort of putting their life on the line as they wander through it and bringing out a piece of nonfiction, and also somebody who's sort of decided to engage with that period through research and see if that can be magicked up in fiction, which is The Innocent. So delighted to welcome you. Let's have a round of applause to support my the first question just for both of you is, what brought you to Russia as your theme? What really engaged you writing about Russia and yourself in giving your life to Russia in many ways?
Well, my book, The Innocent, really I had no specific interest in Russia until I came across a case study, a medical case study written by a Russian neuropsychologist called A.R. Luria. And that was looking at a Russian soldier who'd been wounded in the Second World War and had consequently had a very complex and profound pattern of mental disabilities, and who had been able to some extent to overcome those disabilities by writing, which for him was a very tortuous and difficult process, but one that allowed him to piece together some sort of past, because he had terrible amnesia, and also a sense of the present, because his ability just to perceive the world had been shattered by this head injury. And I was fascinated by that case study, and I wanted to write about that. And I actually considered perhaps taking the basic idea and moving it to a setting that I was more familiar with, but in the end, I decided that to leave it in the Soviet setting made a lot of sense in itself, because the experiment of the Soviet Union, the attempt to remake people's minds, which was what ultimately I think they were attempting to do in the 30s, in the early, the 30s and 40s, in the early days, really chimed with the disabilities of the character and gave that sort of, expanded the whole idea, gave it a real richness and a bigger dimension. So then I had to do a lot of research into the period and into Russia itself, and of course that became fascinating in itself. And then the process of writing something which could create, like any historical novel, create that illusion of time and place became a fascination in itself. So that was how I ended up doing that.
And because I've been to Russia once, it was in 1974 on a school trip, and sort of I think many things have changed since then, but I was struck when I was teaching general studies in the sixth form, just not so many years ago, and that most of the sort of 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds didn't know anything about an East-West divide. They didn't know there was a communist past. It was just a complete avenue of incomprehension to them and no knowledge. And I noticed you've got this name, Zale, S-Z-A-L-A-Y, which suggests
Eastern Europe somehow. It's Hungarian, actually. So I do have my father's Hungarian. He grew up in Hungary, left as an adult in the 60s. And I went back to Hungary in the 70s as a child a lot. So I do have these memories of Hungary in the 70s, which I was able to draw and very much enjoyed drawing on in writing this book, which is set in the 70s. Of course, Russia in the 70s and Hungary in the 70s were probably incomparably different in many ways. But yeah, that did give a personal dimension to it. And because, yeah, my whole family history has been affected by the Soviet Union indirectly, because, I mean, in deep ways, through my father's life. Yeah, so that was definitely another aspect.
And for you, Susan, Russia was this sort of this empire, the other side of an Iron Curtain. And how did you reach across that Iron Curtain for the first time?
Well, originally, I studied it in rather the way that you did, David, when I was a student, because it was on the other side of the Iron Curtain. It was like studying ancient Greek or something like that. I had really no contact with the place, and it was the literature which completely fascinated me. And when I'd finished my studies, I had absolutely no intention of doing anything that Cold Warriors do. I wasn't interested in becoming a spy or a diplomat or anything like that. And I went off and I produced films and was waltzing through my life. And then things started to change in the late 80s in Russia. And I happened to hear something on the radio. It was a news program. And you know there's that particular voice that people have when they're announcing that somebody frightfully important has died? Well, that voice came on. And there was I sort of half heard it. It was on the other side of the house, the radio. And I thought that Gorbachev had been killed. There was something about, I heard the word Gorbachev, and it was clearly death, and my heart just kind of went, and by the time I'd realized that I'd misheard, and it wasn't quite that, I realized that I was much more engaged with this country imaginatively than I'd realized, and I did quite an extreme thing, which was to stop producing movies. Mm-hmm. And wonder where I had put my Russian, and whether and popped in a proposal about trying to find out how ordinary Russians were managing to were experiencing the complete collapse of their worldview. I mean, this worldview that you evoke very well in your novel. I mean, what do they tell their children? How do they get up in the morning once you've discovered that everything that you learned was a pack of lies, everything that you've imbibed in all your life? So that was my first book, and it was terribly exciting to write, because I was the first, I was only meeting people who'd never met Westerners before, and so I was a kind of trophy Westerner, and I was sort of taken home by simple people and slept on their sofas and was passed around the country, and it was a sort of euphoric experience. But then after that, it was like I couldn't stop there, because then communism fell and I wanted to write the sequel. How were people going to live out? I mean, everyone I knew was, you know, sort of just dying to become a Democrat and like the West. And it was, I had to go through the sequel. I didn't have an option. I didn't really want to do it. I just had to do it, because it was sort of soap opera and soap slow motion.
Because it's not the obvious sort of career trajectory, is it? It's not the publishing demands. Sort of one book, win the awards, 19 more years.
It certainly isn't. And it was intended to be a much more conventional book than it's turned out, because, then everything collapsed in Russia, so much worse than I think that we can even begin to understand. I mean, it was it was a revolution in reverse, and the country that I was in was clearly experiencing something which was a collective nervous breakdown, and my original plan for this book had gone up in flames because it wasn't happening, and I was in this place which where everyone was crazy, they didn't want me to be there, and I'd lost the plot. There was no plot. The plot was unraveling. The plot of what Raja was anyway, and that is a very difficult position to be in as a writer, because I also realized that this was one of those sort of crucible moments in Russian history that I had to witness it, but I didn't know what it was I was witnessing.
When did you get a sense of the book structure, the book actually closing out and being a
well, I realized that the only thing I could write about was the people who... most people just didn't want to know me at all. I mean, it was being a Westerner at that juncture when everything was falling apart was not not a happy experience. But the few people who took me in and befriended me became the core of this book, and I followed their lives for the next 17 years. And they were young and bright, I mean, really bright, and they were all absolutely convinced Democrats. And what I watched over this period was their having to survive the death of those first hopes that Russia was going to become an extension of the West. Just very, very briefly, I'd just mention three characters in particular, because they all sort of resonate with the larger sort of terrible drama that's been unfolding in Russia. One of them was a young engineer, a marvelous footballer, very kind of regular guy who was trading in chewing gum and soft drinks. And everybody laughed at him when he said, look, I'm going to be a big businessman. I'm going to be a power in this land. Because he was, you know, he's straight guy, honest, you know, not the kind, they said, you just never survive. And he said, you mark my words, I'm going to make it. And he has made it. And I chart the process of how he does that. And indeed, the terrible price that he has paid for his success. Because operating in Putin's Russia today is very scary. And it's much more scary, he tells me, than operating in the sort of gangland roughy-tufty of the 90s, when you knew you had to hide from the police, and you were always, it was sort of fun. But this is not fun, because here it's the state which is the corrupt. The corruption is all in the state rather than anywhere else. It's not. And second character, who I'd like briefly to mention, because she encapsulates another huge problem, is this girl called Natasha, who's the daughter of a very big cheese in the old Soviet system. And he was a big construction guy in Siberia's capital, Novosibirsk. And I soon spotted that there was something very, very wrong. She was a creature in flight from her own past, and a sort of Russian Orestes, flitting hither and thither, leaving behind all the privileges which she had been born to. And by the time I met her, she was living in penury. And she, for me, encapsulates the problem that Russia has dealing with its past. I mean, trying to handle a past quite as black as that. What, can you face it, or do you just have to escape from it?
Right.
And thirdly, my favorite character, called Anna, is the most passionate Democrat of all, is somebody who was left with an enormous crisis of identity by the fall of communism. Because once it was clear that democracy was not going to work, she and the whole country, indeed, was left with this question of, who am I if I'm not communist? What does it mean to be Russian? And that's the drama through her that I followed through the next couple of decades, really.
Right. That's good.
I think I better stop.
So you've got, your book is peopled with very, very real people who also become characters in your book. And David, you were left to create your book, create the characters in your book. So
yeah.
You've mentioned the one who brought us the urine. That's not urine. Udin.
Yeah.
The day. And but then Alexander.
Udin was the starting point in terms of starting to think about the book, but he wasn't really viable as a central character because he's, you know, well, you'd have to write a completely different sort of novel to, you know, do that. So I had to find a plot.
Explain who Udin is. He's the one with the damaged.
Yes, he's the brain. The
brain damaged one.
Very closely modelled on the character in the medical case study in terms of his problems and so on. But it was obviously important to find a plot in which he could play a part. And in fact, the central character is a MGB, which was what the state security police were called at that time, officer who is investigating Udin because of some activities which took place before he was injured. And Udin was then thought to be dead and then discovered not to be. So the case sort of comes back to life. And I suppose what fascinated me most about that character and why I wrote the book in the end, because I didn't feel entirely comfortable about writing a book set in a time and a place which was very alien to me. But I became completely fascinated with trying to imagine the worldview of this secret police officer at the time. Somebody who was essentially sincere, not a villain in terms of he doesn't realize that what he's doing is wrong. Because when I was doing the research for this book, what moved me most about that period was that there were people like that, especially in the 30s, I think, in the Soviet Union. There were people who genuinely thought that what they were doing was good and were genuine idealists.
Yeah, I wondered about that. Are you actually questioning that now, still? I mean, do you think they might have been right? You write in there that he said the most important thing was our efforts to move towards communism, to move towards it in people's mind. And he was against that nihilistic modern writing of the West that he felt was disturbing that.
Yes.
I got the sense that communism was an actual ideal in this man's sort of mind that he needed nurturing and needed protecting. And was that something you're exploring, that sense of protecting a moral value that was
protecting a moral value, but also the idea of a sort of a purely secular idealism, mm-hmm. which has a sort of religious force, which it had, I think, for people in the 1930s in the mm-hmm. Soviet Union.
And much later.
And in your book, Susan, it shows very clearly how, after the fall of communism, that force kind of transmuted itself back into straightforwardly or mystical or more mystical forms of idealism. I was very interested in looking at that, in looking at how somebody could be so wrong, because obviously it was a terrible evil that took place ultimately. But it's out of genuine idealism and with sincerity. I just thought that was...
If you were having this conversation with a lot of Russians today, they would hotly contest the fact that he was so wrong. I mean, the wheel has turned that much of a circle that it's people are very are romanticizing the Stalinist period.
I know. But I suppose the other key thing about the character in my book is that there's an absolutism that also makes it like religious belief, religious faith. There's a there was an absolutism which meant that anything was justified. So he's able to justify things, you know, killings and terrible violence, and even the sort of accidental and incidental destruction of innocent people, if necessary, to move towards this ideal future, which he believes is the human destiny and can't be avoided. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Well, Christianity had no difficulty with the idea of murder.
Absolutely, no, absolutely. I mean, that's
the people who are in history's past.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and other forces as well. I mean, it's not. It's a common.
So you weren't deliberately trying to take stereotypes and that we have in the West, but one of them is, it's not a stereotype, but it's a common view that the way geniuses were put into asylums in Russia. Can you give us an example of a wayward genius who is insane, who isn't put in an asylum, and the communist agents are trying for their own various reasons to haul him out?
I think that was it. I mean, Susan will know more about this than I do, but I think that was a different period. I think the asylum, that was more in the 70s, wasn't it, when they used mental institutions as a way of sweeping people under the carpet, essentially. Whereas in the 40s, it was more, I mean, essentially, he wants to see, his initial mission at the start of the book is to ascertain whether this Udine is in a fit state to face a trial. Mm. Because it's also another thing which is extraordinary reading about the period, it was quite legalistic. I mean, there was not legality in a sense we would recognize, but there was legalism. Everything was very bureaucratic. There was lots of form filling. Even, you know, people who were taken out of their house in the middle of the night, there was lots of paperwork around that. Mm. The system was continually justifying itself in documents, in outward forms. Mm. And that also interested me, the way it could create a veneer of normality almost. Because it was just people in offices filling out forms, going through bureaucratic routines, who collectively were undertaking this massive repressive project. But for all of them individually, or most of them, or many of them, they were just working in offices and that sort of.
And then you're left with having to conjure that into sort of a living, breathing world. I wonder if you could now read us that little part from that book when Alexander is going off into the forest, and both of the books have this pattern of people escaping that city life and the bureaucratic life to find themselves in a forest somehow.
He stops. He is about to tell the story of how he went to Metelyevlog for the second time, when spring had transformed the forest. However, there was something that he omitted from the story of his first visit. Then, for most of the time, it rained. His memories of the place are mostly of rainy weather, of misty rain that glistened on the nap of coarse cloth like the grey collar of her coat. There was only one sunny day while he was there. He woke to find the knot holes in the window shutters fiercely white. From somewhere outside, he heard the slow strokes of an axe. The sun was warm. Insects sported in its warmth. The sound of the axe was coming from the side of the house where the wood pile was, and there on a scarred tree stump, she was splitting logs into smaller pieces. Later they went for a walk. Unselectively, the sun highlighted small pieces of the forest. He was not dressed for the sort of walk she had in mind, in his suit trousers and waistcoat and filthy shirt. His leather-soled shoes slipped on the wet clay, and he walked more slowly than she did, stopping to peer into the long shadowy perspectives of the wood, where the light shapeshifted under the trees when the wind softly moved their foliage. "I saw a bear once," she said. "Here?" She nodded. "It was just walking along. I don't think it saw me." "Were you scared?" "No. Maybe I should have been." "Maybe. What time of year was it?" "This time of year, spring, 2 years ago. "Then you should have been scared," he said. "It's this time of year they're most dangerous, when they've just come out of hibernation and they're starving." "I know." So I stood very still and watched it walk past. It was about 50 meters away, moving through the trees, slowly, not in a hurry. Sometimes it lifted its head and sniffed the wind. Then suddenly I had an impulse to make a noise, to shout out. I hope you didn't. I shouted, "I'm here." He thought she was joking and laughed. Then she said, I did. And when he still looked skeptical, as if he did not know whether to take her seriously or not. Yes, I did. Why? I don't know. What did it do? What do you think? It just looked at me. I don't know if it saw me. Even then, I wasn't scared. I just wondered if it would kill me. For a long time, it didn't move. It seemed like a long time. It was probably only a few seconds. Then it walked on. I see. Well, please don't do that if we see one today. She laughed. The forest had a strangely empty look. The narrow trunks of the pines were as straight as pencils, the only branches higher up where there was sunlight. They were walking on fallen pine needles, epochs of them, as she pointed out, and it was like walking on a mattress. He told her that he was originally from a village and had lived there until he was 12. I've forgotten almost everything about it now. Forgotten what? How to milk a cow. When I was a child, I had to help my parents with the milking. She seemed uninterested and lit a papirosa. The path went straight up an ivy-covered slope. Initially, he mistook the sound of water for the wind. Only when the wind stopped and the whole forest stood very still for a moment did he understand that what he was hearing was water, an unvarying, high, soft sound, and then quite suddenly, unmistakably watery. In the shifting shade under the trees, the stream flowed down a natural stairway of stones, shallow pools perpetually overflowing. The air was empty, pure. The shadows had the frigidity of early spring. From an open space, they were able to turn and see the lake in its valley, and the monumental clouds mirrored in its surface, which was perfectly still. The soil was waterlogged and soaked through the seat of his trousers. They walked slowly down. It was mid-afternoon, warm and sleepy, when a house was visible through the trees at the end of its short path. He waited on the wooden steps for her to unlock the door. Oh, I forgot to lock it, she said. She opened it and went in. Immediately, he heard Lazovsky's voice. Nadia, have you seen the Czechist? The impersonal tone of this hurt his feelings. He had been there, living with them, for more than a week. Oh, you're here, Lazovsky said. It was quite dark inside the house. Lazovsky was smiling. Well, good news, he said. What's that? The line's open. The line? The railway line. What, already? We got a telegram an hour ago. He lit the unlit papirosa that he was holding. The train will be through at the usual time today. You don't look very pleased, he said through the smoke. Of course I'm pleased. Sitting at his desk, staring at the typewriter, he is suddenly aware of the spectral thunder of a jet. A vapor trail is visible in the sky. The plane itself is not visible. Silently in the stratosphere, the trail disperses. He spends very little time away from his flat. A fortnight in the Crimea every summer, a KGB sanatorium on the sea, swimming in the hot, sulfurous pools. Perhaps an excursion to the Nikitsky Botanical Gardens in Yalta. That's all. And even that seems too much, especially when he has to pack his small suitcase and sit waiting for the loud honk of the bus when it stops in front of the house. Unhappy, silent, slightly lost, he takes his seat among the others in their short-sleeved shirts and sunglasses, and slowly they wind through the eastern suburbs of the city, then out to Koltsovo. He first flew in a plane the year Gagarin went to space. That flight, like all the others he has made since, was between Sverdlovsk and Simferopol. In the years before that, they would spend days on the train, slowly leaving the stress of their work, which they never talked about, while the shadows of trees flickered on their sleeping faces. The vapor trail has dispersed. The sky's mineral blue is intact. He sits down at his desk and stares at the words he has typed.
Thank you. I asked you to sort of read that thinking that you were, it was going to lead into, you know, your tales of how you'd sort of trekked across by train to sort of the far east of Russia and walked through this forest. And I was going to ask you, did you take notes? Did you take photographs? And how did you manage to sort of know, how did you then take your real experience and put it into this man's life? Then I learned, you know, before coming here, that you've never been to Russia in your life. So, but you are giving us the, you're giving us the sounds, and it seems like a very Russian. Does it seem like a Russian forest to you? You've been in them, and we're seeing the light pass. But so were you just staring in your window in London, looking out and casting a Russian?
When I was thinking of the forest, and that whole setting in the Urals of the lake and the forest and so on. I was thinking actually specifically of a forest in the Adirondacks in New York State in America, where my grandparents had a house where I spent a lot of time as a child. And I mean, that's why, I mean, yeah, that was the forest I was specifically thinking of, which Is it like a Russian forest? I have really no. Yeah, they
come in many kinds.
Right. So really, it's like it's a conjuring trick as well. You capture people and take them through a forest.
That became very much part of the appeal of writing the book, to create or try and create an illusion of a place that was essentially unknown to me.
Right. Picking up names from the research.
I mean, I did most of the research I did was into the psychology of people at that time, rather than into the topography or the physical environment in which they lived. Although, of course, that just came through naturally in reading about it. And I really wanted to focus on the psychology and the emotional states and belief states of the characters, rather than really get into the sort of sights and sounds and smells of the time, though I hope that is convincingly conveyed as well. Because of course you need that in order to make the characters meaningful to the reader.
You took me with you, I was there. and moving back to yours, I was wondering where your book was going to take me when I started it. And I read this line, the transition from communism had brought to the surface all forms of spiritual quackery. It's quite a bold statement. Then on a boat trip, which is near the beginning of the book, you meet this Rasputin-like figure that does have a sort of an evil, sort of demonic power to him, that you flee, and there's a certain sexual tension around him, and he is a dangerous person. And so we have this sort of demonic energy that's around. And I think the book is going to debunk that. But then sort of really far from it. It becomes quite an avid spiritual quest in many ways. You head off to meet pagan healers. You go on very long journeys to meet New Jerusalem communities, to go back to the wilds. Sort of Amish style groups that's trying to have nothing to do with modern life. And you enter this professor's extra-dimensional machine, which I've actually sort of met in another book. I sort of once sort of interviewed the Siberian psychiatrist, Olga Karatidi, who went into the same book herself, into the same machine herself in Agadem Garad. Worked with her on a latter book, The Master of Lucid Dreams. But I thought you were going to be the flip side of that. She was feeling that the Russia needed that shamanic world brought back to it to bring it back to life, that it's something that had died. So part of her mission was to restore that. But I wonder how this sort of willful spiritual quest that's part of the book took hold in you, because it probably doesn't sound like it was there in the 1990 version of your travels.
Well, it was no part of my intention, but if you're an honest observer, you have to take seriously what you begin to find. And the extraordinary social upheaval was throwing up. It was this huge vacuum left where communism had been, an enormous great sort of hole, and the things that were rushing into that vacuum were all kinds of, well, there was hocus pocus spirituality, but there was also something else. There were other things which were very potent and true, and had things with very deep roots in Russia, which I couldn't, which were being thrust in front of me, and it would have been a dishonest observer not to have tried to understand them in their own terms. Mm-hmm. So
it became a little more avid than that, didn't it?
I
smiled in the book, and suddenly Susan was saying, oh fine, I've heard about this healer in this very distant part of the country that's impossible to get to. I've got to go now. So it was there was a compulsion that was there, an inner compulsion.
Yes, indeed, and my own liberal secular baggage, which I had started off with, was entirely jumped by the extraordinary richness of the things that were happening around me. Mm-hmm. And so much so that the first of the encounters which I had with things beyond my ken was so bizarre that I'll just describe it briefly. For completely boring reasons, I went to a town in the middle of Uzbekistan which I didn't know anything about, and I found that an epidemic of the supernatural had been happening there. Everybody, I mean, hundreds of people at a time were seeing UFOs coming down, and people were having conversations with people from UFOs, and there were hairy devils crawling through windows. Everybody was coming to the communist bosses with stories, and all those stories made a single sort of whole. I mean, they were coherent one with another, as if they had been written by the same author. And so you couldn't say they were bonkers, because if they were bonkers, they were all bonkers in the same way. And I, for reasons that I can't go into for shortness of time, was in this place for only, well, a couple of days. And then I had to get out in a great hurry. So I was left with this sort of mystery in my hands. And when I started to write it, I realized that if you write something without comprehension, it comes out as a sort of mocking story. You know, I was a sort of Westerner writing about these funny little people over there seeing weird things. And it was very nasty and diminishing. And I didn't like the me that I found reflected in that kind of storytelling. And because I didn't like it, it forced me onto a much deeper journey of comprehension,
right,
which I wouldn't have gone on otherwise, and which took me in marvelous and very different directions.
Maybe you could read us about one of those now.
Yes,
ominous title.
This very briefly is one of the things that surfaced at the fall of communism was something that I didn't know had survived communism at all, which was that at Peter the Great's time, there was a great religious schism in Russia in the church, and it was a schism that symbolized really those who would accept Peter the Great's embrace of modernity and the attempt to take Russia forward and make it into a European nation, versus those who resisted that and were very heavily persecuted for it. I mean, they were whole churchfuls of them were burned alive, and they headed off to the snowy waste in the north and into the depths of the forest. And those of us who minded about Russia sort of assumed that these people had just disappeared, been mowed down in the militant atheism of the Soviet period. But there, I mean, I started reading about them, these communities, and I thought, I really, since I was asking the question that my characters were asking, which was, who are we now that we're no longer communist, I set myself the task of going to try and visit one of the best preserved of these communities. And through a series of wonderful pieces of luck, I was taken to such a community. This little chapter is called The Time of the Antichrist. A shaft of evening light shone through the window onto Philemon's fair hair, picking up its reddish tinge and the tips of his curly beard, leaving his face in shadow. Today, he was much more relaxed. His friendship with the Alexeyevs went back many years. They were more than scholars of the old belief. They were his allies, guardians of the tradition, mediators between the old believers and a Russia which regarded them merely as backward peasants. Vladimir Nikolaevich was showing me Philemon's collection of books. Some were brilliantly illuminated. Some dated back from before the schism. Many were handwritten, including one, unusually, which was copied by a woman, Philemon's mother's godmother. Philemon had been talking about the difficulties he was having. There was rising nationalism among the Evenki, native hunter-gatherer Siberians. After the fall of communism, this territory was designated as their homeland. We're in deep forest here. He dreaded to think what would happen if the Evenki started trying to get them out. The old believers could not, would not, go out into the world. The village was also facing problems with the local authorities. The scale of the corruption was new. They're squeezing us dry. If it were up to me, I know what I'd do. I'd just pack up and go, move on as we've always done, deeper into the forest. But although Philemon was the chief village elder, these decisions were arrived at collectively. On top of all that, there was the problem of prosperity. The rest of Russia might be on its knees, but here the villagers were managing well, too well for Philemon's liking. Prosperity brought choices like televisions and snowmobiles. Philemon sighed deeply. We live in a decadent age. All these distractions and labor-saving devices, they take us away from the physical work which brings us to God. The sins we commit, we wash away through work, through prayers and tears. He sighed and closed his remarkable blue eyes. Man cannot serve two masters. This is the time of the Antichrist. We've got to escape from his snares. We'll have to do it before we meet our Maker. It will take fortitude, determination, self-discipline. Philemon spoke with a peasant burr, but the cadence of his speech and his vocabulary were grand, fashioned by the sacred texts. Any day now, the Antichrist will come. We have no idea when that will be. We're so wrapped up in our lives that we won't even notice. He will creep up on us unawares. He will be sitting right beside us. We must take ourselves in hand, repent. But, he paused. You mean the community isn't ready? Elena Ivanovna prompted him. That's exactly what I mean. It's the path of the few. I've got to accept that. However much they revered the Starets, their lay preacher, this flourishing community was not going to leave everything behind and follow him. That was the tragedy Philemon faced. He sighed. But then again, how can I leave my family? His face looked tortured. Philemon had never expected to become Bornis Starets. His father, who held the position before him, was revered for his piety and leadership qualities. When he resigned, the villagers elected Philemon. In those days, he was something of a rebel in old believer terms. He was and remained the best hunter in the region. His average winter harvest of 200 sables was four times more than most men's. Back then, he read voraciously and wrote poetry. He used to compose verses for each newly built house and write them on the walls, they told me. The community, who were charged by tradition with arriving at a unanimous choice, hoped he would show his father's talent for leadership. Philemon accepted the challenge. He changed his life to embrace the myth of original purity behind the old belief. All of our cultures were once defined by such myths of purity, I'd been reflecting, myths which could not be changed if they were to retain their meaning. But for the Jews, the story of the Garden of Eden was succeeded by the promise of a new Jerusalem. Looking to the future as it did, it unlocked the concept of modernity for us. Yes, I reflected, this is it, the secret of Borny's success. It's vested in this man with his blazing commitment to his faith. He asked a lot of the villagers, but he did not do so by telling them what to do, so much as by challenging them to live up to the example of the books. Philemon was a long way off retiring, but I wondered who would succeed him. Might it even be his madcap oldest son, Ivan, the boy racer with his motorbike? More unlikely things had happened. These old believers saw their lives as a gradual spiritual progression, as I now understood it. Little was expected of the children, and Borny's teenagers danced, smoked, drank, and loved rock music like their counterparts anywhere. Only once they married, which they did early, were they expected to start taking their inner life seriously. From then onwards, it occupied a progressively more important role in their lives, until in the end, the serious men, the women didn't appear to have this choice, retreated to a hut in the forest to devote themselves to the life of the spirit. That's what Philemon's father did when he retired as the village Stariets, and Philemon himself would doubtless do the same in due course. I took my leave and walked back along the raised boardwalk to Maxime's house. Over the fence, Ivan was taking his motorbike to bits. A group of children in rubber boots were driving cows home through the mud. Fetinia was taking her washing off the line. Sociologically, Philemon was just a peasant. Yet in respect of everything he valued, I was the primitive one. And in his presence, I felt it. He had turned his lively intelligence inward and developed resources in himself which were mysterious to me. Philemon was not in a confrontational mood this afternoon, but face to face with him, I felt him measuring my spiritual poverty and that of my world.
Thank you. You speak about these mystical figures, and sort of quoting that from your book, as militant crusaders against rationality, that progressive force which had displaced God and mystery from the center of the world. If asked, I knew they would all agree that we in the West were prisoners of our own achievement. I wondered from here in the West whether you find you want to stand up for rationality at all.
Well, I am left feeling that rationality has gone too far. I think that there's a balance which, at its best, human beings live very well with when those are in a sort of equilibrium. That the world, that there's still a respect for something which defies rationality. Mm. And I think that in our world, that that sphere has been driven into a corner onto the defensive and comes out sometimes in very defensive and strange ways.
I noticed that Anna is one of the major figures in your book, who's a crusading journalist. And there are quite a few links, I think, with the journalist in your book as well. Mm. But she lives a very meager life because of her sort of crusading passion, in a way. I think she's given up a lot, and you go and sort of squeeze your life into hers, you know, sharing her single room existence, and you try and give her gifts. And it's like these munificent gifts from the West, which she always rejects. And similarly, in a way, in your book, you have the chess match between Spassky and Fischer. Mm. And Fischer becomes like quite a manic figure there. And your Alexander says that he has not engaged with the world morally in any way. And I wondered if both of your books are actually trying to address something of a moral deficit in the West.
I felt that, as I said before, reading about the very idealistic strain of militant Leninism, Marxism in the Soviet Union in mostly the pre-war period, I felt that that was an attempt to combine. Obviously, it was very materialistic, and it's rigorously materialistic in its worldview, and very rational and empirical. But it tried to create an idealistic force out of those materials, and failed. And because I do feel that that has left us in a place where the idea of a secular idealism has been tainted by the whole Soviet phenomenon. And at the same time, we are empirically minded. We are, rationalism is our creed, and it's not easy just to sort of shelve that. I mean, I think that's just what we have. We have to somehow work within that. We can't just ignore that, because it's deeply part of us. So in that sense, that was part of the sense of tragedy I had about the events in the Soviet Union, that it was an attempt to do something with that aspect of our civilization that ultimately ended in failure and has left us in a place without much visionary sort of view of the future of any sort.
Do you feel that writing for you then is fueled by being able to sort of go out there into the East, both of you really, to go out into the East and pick up values from another world and come back? I certainly found with myself that I used to go away, and I'd, when I came back, I'd be vibrant for a while. I'd be challenging everything. You go to the Middle East and you discover that there was a completely different side to the Palestine question that never gets touched on in our papers. And I'd come back and I'd be this sort of moral crusader myself. And then I could see it getting dim. And by the end of 2 weeks, I could feel myself having sort of retreated to the norm and just not being able to be sharp enough to take things on anymore. But is that part of the journey for you as writers to go out there and sharpen yourselves and then bring that message back into the culture here?
I mean, I didn't physically go anywhere, obviously, writing this book.
Yeah,
hungry, sure. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. But it was more of a sort of imaginative journey. And I was very keen to imagine what the Cold War looked like from a Soviet perspective. Because obviously, it does look different. I mean, because we were the victorious side, history records that we were just right. Mm-hmm. And of course, what happened in the Soviet Union was absolutely terrible for much of the time. But there was, you know, their perspective on events was different. And I was fascinated to try and imagine how events, that's why I did bring in the Fischer-Spassky and the 72 Olympics and so on, just to try and see well-known events from the other side.
For that Western
yes, exactly.
I suppose you were the route in, really. You were the narrative link in your book, your own journey. And you went from sort of west to east into Russia, but also you kept going from the city out into the rural areas and back again. So it seems as though that we have this sort of west-east divide between ourselves and, say, Moscow. But there seemed to be an equivalent west-east divide between Russia that you kept bridging. And you go out and you'd find what would be the mystical spiritual realms, then almost come back into the city and then have to sort of fit into a realm of friendship and comradeship, where that spiritual thing was somewhere absent. So you seem to be carrying that east-west search from within Russia.
That's true. In Russia, partly because of its vastness. I mean, it does divide very much into sort of oil and vinegar. The Western style enclaves of the city, and then something else which on the whole people of the education this room are incredibly sort of sniffy about, you know, the countryside and you know, backwards, and they would look at me in incredulity and say, "You're not off to your countryside again." But I was more and more mesmerized by this countryside, because it was there that all these extraordinary, whether it was millennial sects or you know, the surfacing of real paganism of a kind which had survived 11 centuries since the coming of Christianity, and all these things were happening there, and for me it was a much more exciting place than just the sort of same old hodgepodge of city that we have in the West, you know.
You keep going east until you arrive home again, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
So I'd like to open it up to everybody else, please. And any questions? We have a roving mic. And I should have given you a warning, but this is... come on. Oh, there's one coming.
Hi, this is mostly on religion in Russia today. I don't know if you know this. In America, there's this new tendency for, there's a religious right wing which tries to impose itself in classrooms and, for example, teach creationism alongside evolution and all that. Is there a similar movement in Russia? And on another vein, are there any Christian-based or Russian relief programs, because I attended a Russian Orthodox church in Nice, and it was quite surprising for me because the sermons were mostly biblical quotations in Old Slavonic and, of course, the Great Litany, but there didn't seem to be much talking about current events or how we should live our lives. Could you perhaps enlighten me?
Well, no, it is. You're right. You picked up on something fundamental to the break between Western and Eastern Christianity, which is that they all their services and so on are in this archaic language, which if you speak modern Russian, you won't understand it at all easily, and that indeed after the fall of communism made it very difficult for people who wanted to reapproach their own religion, because on the one hand they couldn't understand what was going on the other hand the priests, by the time communism was over, were low grade, they were informers, they were half educated, they were not, they didn't have much to offer sort of inquiring, intelligent people with a spiritual quest. And so there was a lot, it wasn't easy for people to kind of get under the skin of that, but indeed I kind of did a journey of my own of trying to get beyond that through the character of mine who became very orthodox. And I discovered partly through her and partly through my own explorations that that beyond this very unattractive sort of carapace, unchanging carapace, was the mystical heart of Eastern Christianity, of Orthodoxy, has remained unchanged really since the sort of 6th century. And that's what's really so exciting about it. And they would, from their point of view, they look at Western Christianity and see it as being fatally tainted by rationality, by our attempt to try and understand even God and the mystery of faith. Whereas for Eastern Christianity, the mystery is the mystery, and you have to accept it. And so you can't just go changing the service and things like that. You have to accept those as part of the wrapper that comes with this thing inside, which you can't just put words to. So yes, it's not in the same way that the Western Church is. It's not as pastoral either. In Protestantism has flourished into good works in a way which is very, very much part of its sort of central energy. But for Orthodoxy, at the heart of it is the mystery of faith, and it makes it quite a difficult conversation of incomprehension.
There was a story this week of a Russian Orthodox priest being murdered. He had a track record of trying to convert Muslims. Are you aware of this story?
Actually, I don't know about that. I mean, I've been very much caught up in a different murder, which happened of a lawyer, but you know, that doesn't surprise me. But
because I mean, one thing I thought I'd followed was that there was a resurgence of the church in Russia, but it was very much associated with a rather ugly nationalism very often.
Well, there are two things going on. There is the rise of radical Islam in more in Central Asia and than actually inside Russia. Within Russia, the Muslims are more moderate, and but so I'm not quite sure exactly where this murder took place, but you're right that the church, miraculous though it is in its spirituality, in its it is highly politicized in large part, and the politics of it are indeed captured by a very nasty elements of Russian nationalist right, who are extremely xenophobic, extremely racist, and very proselytizing.
As a writer, that I was thinking of asking you lots of questions about all that sort of terrible stuff, that the authoritarianism, the cult of the leader, the persecution of freedom-loving journalists, etc. But I thought, well, you've sort of touched upon that very much in your book anyway. Could you maybe say something to us a little bit about the wonderful cultural achievements of Russia that you may have encountered?
Well, I must say that in general, one of the things which is incredibly nourishing about being there, and even in very, very backward parts, is the seriousness with which they take their culture. And they read seriously. They read their theology, literature, history, and they talk about what they read. And so in that very good sense, it feels like a very old-fashioned place where that culture has this very sort of living, it's this living driving force. But of course they are awash with the same forces that we are. I mean, the same crap television, the same, you know, and friends of mine are very eloquent about the fact that the way in which ideology, the way in which the regime controls people today is just as this regime here controls us through the mass media, through dumbing everything down. They regard us as being basically controlled to an extent that we don't really recognize by mass communication. I mean, and just the way we consume television, the way we consume film, and the lack of space that leaves us for independent creativity, independent thought. They think that we are greatly gulled by how we think we're freer than we are.
Apropos that, I was just interested in the way that both of you, when you speak about communist Russia, use only negative terms. And I wondered, it seems to me it's a highly triumphalist post-Cold War stance. And I don't imagine that either of you necessarily feel that. But I wondered why it was that everything is so negative about communism and you don't look at any of the positive aspects of what might have happened.
Well, actually, I mean, you answer, so I've got lots of things to
say. I just want to say that in my book, I really did try, and what I was saying earlier about trying to imagine how the Cold War and also the West looked from the perspective of a sincere Marxist in the 40s and even later in the 70s was part of the appeal of writing the book for me, precisely because the way he, I mean, there's a lot of truth in the way that my character perceives our culture in the West. Of course, he is just as misguided in his view of us as we are in our view of him or them. But I was very keen to bring out the fact that it wasn't all negative, that there was a sort of a balance in a way of view of our views of each other. And one of the reasons I used Bobby Fischer was because he was such a heinous character in many ways, who did embody many of the worst aspects of our culture. And so my Alexander, my central character's view of him, very negative, of course, and he was portrayed obviously extremely negatively in the Soviet media, but there was a lot of truth in that. And I was keen to bring that out very much.
Far from feeling what I was observing after the fall of communism actually broke my heart, because in the provinces, the whole infrastructure of social provision, whether it was hospitals, children's nurseries, places for children to go in summer holidays, palaces of culture, the whole provision, which was countrywide and even in very, very backwards places, which was completely accessible to the poor, all that, because of the disastrous way in which the triumphalist free market moved in on Russia, all that was absolutely ripped up and just not sustained. And in the context of a country which is basically, despite its oil and gas, a very poor country, I mean, the wealth is all, it's soil, and its ability to make riches in a distributed way, I mean, from off the land, so on, is very limited. So the poor are much, much poorer there than they are in Europe or America. And for them, the experience of living in a non-communist world is infinitely poorer. So I don't, I'm sorry if I gave that impression, because I think the reality is much more complex, and I think Russia's a very, very difficult and disastrous place to live in today in many ways, and the amount of suicides and people and death from drinking in the countryside, colossal rate of suicide, is very much evidence of the despair that has moved into these whole huge areas which have become post-socialist. Indeed, I think that I would say that part of the plight we're in now is because we no longer have an other, which we were competitive enough to feel that we needed to keep a sort of social side of ourselves going as long as communism existed. And now that that other has gone, I think that we are suffering grievously. West.
Hello. You followed the lives of people for 17 years. Were they aware that you were writing about them?
Very much so.
And did that change how they lived their lives?
It didn't, because there wasn't in any of their lives enough scope for them to do anything differently than the way they were doing them. They were fighting to survive the chaos and survive the madness too urgently for there to be any self-consciousness about that.
Did you sort of stop by every now and then and catch up on what had been happening?
Yes, I mean, I would go every year or sometimes 2 years and then spend a good wodge of time with them. And yes, I mean, they certainly knew, but it doesn't mean it's easier for either of us now that I've published the book.
And how did you select the people in the first place?
Well, in the simplest possible way, which is that mostly people were so hostile to me after the fall of communism, because I seemed to symbolise what I wasn't at all, the victorious sort of triumphalist forces of capitalism. And this was a very embarrassing position to find myself in, because I didn't feel like that. And those people who took pity on me became my friends. And so it was a self-selection process.
Ian Thompson's book, The Dead Yard, about Jamaica, is not available really in Jamaica because the elite took a dim view of his book because there are some very minor criticisms of them. Well, you know, they thought it was more than that, so the book is not available in Jamaica. Is your book available in Russia, and what's been the response to it?
Well, it's an unresolved question, because it only came out this summer, and in a week or two's time, there's going to be a big review of it coming out in Russian with a couple of excerpts written by a really well-known novelist and painter, and who's done that in order to try and provoke somebody into translating it. Because it's true that although lots of sort of, I mean, I don't think most people are nutty enough to go and spend that much time really trying to absorb what was really going on, as opposed to, you know, just a sort of casually tossing off a Western view. And this friend of mine certainly thinks that that the Russians have got a lot to learn of my perceptions of the Russian countryside and what was going on out there after the fall of communism. I doubt it will be translated, but I very much hope it will be. As far as availability in English, nobody would mind it being read in English by anybody, because it's only the elite that speaks English, and that's not, you know, they wouldn't mind about that.
David, your book, you were told that your book would just never come out.
Well, I was told it was highly unlikely. I did actually do an interview with Radio Free Europe about it, and I was quite, when that happened, I was quite sort of, you know, excited that there might be the possibility of some sort of Russian translation of the book, because this would obviously be broadcast in Russia. But I was told that it's very unusual for, I don't know so much about non-fiction, but I was told that it was very unusual for non-Russian fiction set in Russia to be translated. It just wasn't, the Russians just didn't really go for it. So, I mean, obviously, like Susan, I very much hope it is, but I'm not optimistic.
I think that we're into a phase in Russia of things Western being regarded with the wheel has turned, and to the extent to which they were incredibly keen on Western things now, we are not culturally or in any other respect held in any favor. So anything coming from us, whatever our however sympathetic our standpoint might be,
suspect. Yeah.
Very suspect.
You mentioned a kind of a sniffiness and a backwardness about Russia in the past and the present, of these sort of peasant rituals that you talk about, and so on and so forth. And correct me if I'm wrong in my characterization, but I almost feel there's a kind of colonial lens to it that people also apply to sort of modern China, and they say they are sort of fundamentally backwards, and eventually they'll evolve, and there'll be, you know, a Chinese and a Russian kind of House of Commons, and so on and so forth, and they'll be like us. And then there's the other side of that axis, again, in my opinion, where people are kind of quite pessimistic and they're resigned to the fact that there's a different Russian national character, where, you know, strong leadership, which is sort of evidenced by this kind of modern resurgence of Stalin, saying, you know, he was a strong leader and things were better before the sort of Western ideas came over. I was wondering, both of you, how you sort of feel, if there's a particular side you come down on that axis, or if it's just generally how you feel about that sort of.
I think it's more complicated still. My own perception is that the very best of Russia will always be non-Western, and not only talking in spiritual terms and cultural terms, and in terms of philosophy and theology, and the riches are. The rich places are places which are not feeding off Western models, which are looking much more to the heart of Russian traditions. And I think that the rift between the Western and the Slavophile or the other culture is incredibly, it's very deep. And it'll never go away. And, in an ideal world, Russia would never have been opened up for the West, because the contact with the West has been a sort of disaster, really, for things Russian. It turns things bad.
Well, I mean, the whole Soviet Union was obviously, through Marxism, a gigantic example of that, presumably. I mean, the communist Marxism was a Western idea that the Russians took. And in your book, you say, quote something very interesting, I can't remember who said it, about that contact producing a sort of demonic result, that obviously.
But it was a Western idea, Marxism, which then tried to take a national form, and so you know there's a constant tension between those, and there always will be, but it's a creative tension too.
Sorry, that was so provocative. I feel I have to respond to it. This issue that the opening up to the West was a disaster for Russia. The elite would always speak in French, wouldn't they, in Tolstoy's novels, etc. And you can go back way beyond that, The Window on the West and St. Petersburg. Surely, though, there is a very strong strain, as there is around the world, of terrible things happening within cultures. What about Ivan the Terrible? What about people within Russia way back when, before any tainting virus coming in from the West? I mean, that surely is a rather, well, very provocative, to say the least, statement.
Yes, it is provocative. What I mean slightly more precisely is that the way that opening out happened was a sort of cultural rape. It didn't have the advantage of happening gradually. It was imposed from the top, violently. And Peter the Great chopping off the beards, it was all violent. And that violence has remained in the contact and not been good. And it's happened again with Bolshevism. But it goes back to geography. Russia is off the beaten track of, it's ideas, it wasn't, the Silk Road doesn't go through the middle of Russia. It's not got ports bringing ideas from the outside world. Ideas travel very, very slowly into a land like mass like that. And it hasn't done the Russians any good at all when, yet again with Yeltsin too, a new set of ideas was suddenly plonked down. And the collision is not good for the Russian character, and it leaves wounds. The wound that was perpetrated, I believe, in 91-92 by the brutal inception of the free market, is one that is going to play itself out in the international arena for a long time.
Very much. So thanks a lot for coming. I keep saying that it's you that make these Larkin Center events happen, so thank you very much for being here. One little sort of plug for the one remaining event of the season, Hilary Mantel coming to be in conversation about her writing life. That's 2 weeks today, December the 9th. I also keep amusing myself by sort of plugging Waterstones, because they really have done a remarkably considerate and careful job at arranging the selections of books that are around today. Including David's sort of first novel and the new one and Susan's book. So they're there in really seductive and attractive piles in memory of Christmas coming as well. I'm going to actually be buying sort of one each myself, even though I've read them. It's because they make, they're presents that make people think you think they're intelligent. So presents for the intelligent people at the back. You can buy multiple copies, get them individually signed. And I'd just like to say thank you very much to sort of David and to Susan for coming this way and giving us such an engaging and an involved and handsome conversation. Thank you very much. So there will be signings at the back, and look forward to seeing you again in a couple of weeks and thereafter.